It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. UW-Madison ranks eighth in the country for research and development spending, while Johns Hopkins University leads the nation with over $3 billion in R&D expenditures. Calculations there by the National Science Foundation for 2022, and we discuss spending priorities and challenges in academic research at Wisconsin's flagship campus. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cynthia Chakowski is Interim Vice Chancellor for Research at UW-Madison and a Professor of Neuroscience at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Cynthia, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. I'm excited to be here. Good morning.
Good morning. So UW-Madison ranked sixth in the nation for research funding a few years ago when it was receiving hundreds of millions of dollars less in research grants. Why is the ranking lower today, even though the funding for research is up?
I would say it's a little complicated in that at one time, we had some cuts in faculty, and there was a decrease in the number of faculty on campus. And so we saw this drop, but I would really like people not to focus on these numbers. So unlike whether we're eighth or fifth or fourth, right now it's pretty amazing. For the first time, we exceeded over $1.5 billion in research expenditures. And that increase actually came by about with a 10% increase. And the research expenditures you could think of is a measure of our productivity. And this ranking is over like 900 public and private universities. So being ranked eighth is pretty good. But we're actually really closing the gap with the three institutions right above us. So we're behind Washington University by 36 million, UCLA by 13 million, and UCSD by only 10 million. And so our research growth is actually been 10% in the last year, and then, or the year between, the HERD ranking is based on our expenditures on 2022. But so we are closing that gap. And so I would really say, when we're thinking of something between like 35 million, when we're dealing with like 1.53 billion, like we're right up there.
Mm-hmm.
there's a lot of wiggle room there. Well, and I really, partially, UW is, we're really excited to see this growth. And our growth rate was the second highest.
Well, rankings aside, though, you know, research expenditures, they are one way to measure a university's productivity in research, as you said. What other indicators should we be paying more attention to?
We should be really paying attention to what kind of awards that our research scholars and also our inventors are doing. What are how do we take our research discoveries and really move it into innovations for the public good? And so what I would say is UW-Madison is unique for both our breadth and depth of our research, which spans from scholarship in the arts to space satellite research that makes weather forecasts more possible. But we're really in this idea, the Wisconsin idea of innovation for the public good, is also really unique. And I would love to give you an example of that.
Sure.
If that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
And here's an example. And there's an assistant professor who is in the Department of Animal and Dairy Sciences in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. And her name is Jennifer Van Os. And what she was really interested in, she went across the state talking to dairy farmers, saying, what do you need? What is lacking? And what they said is they really needed something to help them improve cow handling skills in dairy farm personnel. And so Jennifer is really a serious researcher in trying to develop games, serious games. So what her goal was to create a digital serious game to transform training in farm animal handling. And so she got together a multidisciplinary team, including human health, behavioral changes, vet medicine, animal welfare, and they have a game called, gotta love this, Moving Cows. and it's a game to improve cow handling skills. And the app is now available. I tell everyone online, go on either iTunes or Google Play app stores. And they now, in response to this, so this research being done at UW is then being going out to the rest of the state and also the world. So that's just one example.
You find a problem, and here is a innovative, perhaps practical solution in cow handling. We are talking with Cynthia Tchaikovsky, the university's interim vice chancellor for research, as we discuss the growth of funding at UW-Madison for research. Call in with questions and comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Cynthia, along the lines of technology, this is not in dairy, but the School of Computer Data and Information Sciences that is under construction when the school opens next year, how will it fit into the plans announced by the chancellor last month to advance artificial intelligence research?
Perfect question. Thanks so much, Kate. There is tremendous excitement on campus watching this construction of the new School for Computer Data and Information Science, which I'm now going to call CDIS. The building is going to be really this hub of collaboration across university units, working in areas of computer data information sciences. And it's really a place to co-locate departments and also centers, and where high-tech learning and collaboration come together. And the key of how this is going to work with the new initiative, which is the RISE initiative, which the chancellor recently announced, which is research, innovation, and scholarly excellence, which that initiative is not just based in AI. It's really to help address significant, complex challenges of importance to Wisconsin and the world. And the idea is to accelerate and do strategic faculty hiring between 120 and 150 new faculty.
What do you make of that number? Yeah. 120 to 150 new faculty.
Right. And we're going to then, the first focus area is in AI. And so that'll be about 50 faculty, which AI, due to its generally, transformative potential and also its cross-disciplinary, it really is the right one to start. And so we think with this new building, and also what it will do is that it will help us begin to dedicate resources to hiring these scholars. And also we're really excited about this because it's also going to give us opportunities to build and use AI for particular kinds of different kinds of research. One would be in fusion research. So we want to use data science and AI tools to really bring about the promise of safe and renewable clean energy. And so here we're using machine learning tools to accelerate the knowledge of magnetic fusion devices to, and this collaboration will help us move.
And I'm going to jump in right there with Cynthia Tchaikovsky, Interim Vice Chancellor for Research at UW-Madison, Professor of Neuroscience at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Be part of this discussion about research and discoveries. Call in with the question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine UW-Madison's research enterprise and priorities for spending on work in labs and potential innovations. Cynthia Chakowsky is Interim Vice Chancellor for Research at UW-Madison, a professor of neuroscience in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Call in with a question. Share your perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. I want to turn to federal funding. About half of the UW-Madison's research funding is coming from federal grants. Is funding from federal sources on the rise?
Yes, our federal research proposals have risen, at least in the last HERD ranking, 14.5% to $741 million. And so we are getting more and additional monies from federal resources. What's interesting is our federal dollars are more, I would say, distributed abroad versus some other top research universities, in that we have money from both NSF, from the USDA, from the National Institute of Health, also from the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense, while some other universities, let's just say UCSF, have almost all of their monies coming from like NIH because of most of their research funds are focused on medical school.
So, you know, the White House cites more than 20 federal agencies funding research in our country, and the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act created new federal grant programs. I'm wondering, is UW-Madison winning these new grants?
Yeah, this is really exciting, and I know you've probably heard that Wisconsin won a designation as a regional tech hub. Mm-hmm. And those are those tech hub from the federal government. Those are were authorized by the CHIPS and Science Act from the Biden administration. And so we were chosen from, we're a consortium of public and private members. So I would say we are a consortium of, for example, we're working with Medical College of Wisconsin, UW-Madison, our tech colleges, BioForward Consortium of required of multiple biotech companies and industries such as GE Healthcare, Accuray, Exact Sciences, also part of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, and bipartisan support. So all of us got together, which is hard sometimes to get everybody in the same room.
Right, you're name-dropping
really,
big companies, yes.
Right, really drives the state's tech hub designation, because this designation requires public-private partnerships. And so to really drive economic development and workforce build up. So this is not money that's really, we're part of it, and we're a really important part because we are an economic engine in the state, but we are just a part of this. And we were chosen from 371 applications across 49 states. So there were 31 regions selected for this really competitive phase one tech hub designation. And what our specific Wisconsin bio is a Wisconsin BioHealth Tech Hub, which really aims to make the state a global leader in personalized medicine and a healthcare approach that uses patients' genetic sequences, medical records, and environment to diagnose and treat them more efficiently. But
does
here
it,
we're really building,
I was gonna say, does it help having Epic in your backyard and headquartered here?
Yes, and I should have put Epic in there too, because the one thing that UW-Madison is going to be really leading in is in this health data hub. And here we're really working hand in hand with Epic also, because if you want to grapple with when innovators and people need to figure out how do we use personalized medicine, we really need to be able to have a cyber secure repository of health data that's accessible to researchers and then our collaborators in this and industry alike. And so we are building that, and we're building that with the help of also Epic, who's in our backyard, who has a lot of also expertise in this. So we're very excited about this. It opens up millions of dollars in federal funding, and it really is expected to generate a substantial number of new jobs and really boosting our state's economy. We are really a powerhouse in biotechnology across the Milwaukee through Madison region. And so this is a regional, it's like we are crossing over and really trying to partner across all of Wisconsin. And the university's program in medical, and we're also partnering with GE and GE Healthcare, which has its headquarters. So it's amazing. Wisconsin has, we are really strong in manufacturing, but also really strong in healthcare, and trying to combine these, we could become a regional hub of this.
The synergy there. I'm going to reintroduce you, Cynthia Chakowski, with us, University's Interim Vice Chancellor for Research, as we talk about the growth of funding and new efforts at UW-Madison in that area. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Cynthia, topic change here. In January, a state assembly committee held a hearing for a bill that would prohibit gain-of-function research on, quote, potentially pandemic pathogens at higher education institutions. UW-Madison and Medical College of Wisconsin jointly registering opposition to this bill. Can you talk about why?
The bill was really broadly written. And so the way it was written, It was how they defined potentially pandemic pathogens was different than how the federal government defines it. And it would prevent researchers from in both the Medical College of Wisconsin and UW-Madison from performing studies that really contribute to our ability to protect the health of Wisconsinites and also our agricultural industries. For example, the bill would prohibit the university from studying how viruses like Epstein-Barr virus cause cancer, or would prohibit us from trying to do studies to understand how to protect cows from the bacteria that causes bovine mastitis, which is a significant problem for the dairy industry.
So do you think there needs to be like better transparency in this area or clearer definitions? I mean, what are the tensions in, you know, gain of function?
I think some of the tensions, so the phrase gain of function, what people tend to mean when they use this phrase is that you are doing research or on pathogens that make them more infectious or more transmissible or more cause of disease. And the university is not doing research that does that. So, but the goal, if you really think about the goal of that, is to really improve public health and prevent deaths from pathogens that are already arise in nature. So in nature, these things are happening. You know, the pathogens get, you know, we see that with COVID-19. Like, we need more vaccines because the pathogen, the virus, is changing how it looks. So for us to deal with that. But so I think that we have to be very careful about how we are defining this so that we don't stop very crucial experiments on other types of viruses.
In our final seconds together, how confident are you in UW-Madison's management of dangerous pathogens or its biorisk management system?
I'm very, very confident. All research on pathogens at UW-Madison really follows stringent university and federal requirements. Our research labs and PIs and also all our researchers are subject to multiple levels of university and federal government oversight. And we really pride ourselves on our record of safety and compliance. And I actually, if you want to really do more, I would say visit our website on pathogenresearch.wisc.edu, and you really will hear about what we're doing. And also, yes.
Cynthia, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much. I just want to tell everyone, I encourage everyone to come to Madison to attend the university's 175th anniversary.
And I want to, we have to jump in here. Cynthia Chakowski, you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have the mayor of Prairie du Chien as a historic bridge that connects Wisconsin and Iowa over the Mississippi River is abruptly closed due to structural problems. The Cantilever Bridge is the only one crossing between Prairie du Chien and La Crosse. We discuss this issue, other developments in this southwestern Wisconsin community on the upper Mississippi River. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dave Hemmer is mayor of Prairie du Chien in Crawford County. Mayor Hemmer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you much. I appreciate being on with you.
Well, let's discuss the bridge first. The Iowa Transportation Department announcing the closure at Lansing, the bridge connecting Iowa to Wisconsin, a bit north from you. How is the bridge closure affecting traffic in Prairie du Chien?
Well, so far it hasn't been too bad. There's been somewhat of an increase, but we haven't really noticed anything extreme yet. I'm sure once the weather gets warmer and we get on into spring and summer, hopefully they have it back open for those folks up in Lansing by then. But if they don't, I guess they will have to come this way or up to La Crosse.
What do you know about the bridge's problems? What have you heard?
What I have heard from the official Iowa DOT website was that they inspected the bridge and it had moved, and one of the pilings had moved slightly from the driving piling for the new bridge, which is pretty close to almost right alongside, just a little bit to the north, and that the vibration from driving that piling into the bedrock of the Mississippi River made the vibration was bad enough that it moved the old bridge just slightly.
What you're talking about is, you know, massive engineering. It's vital infrastructure to bridge the Mississippi River. What does this bridge closure, what does that say about upkeep and maintenance of bridges and other infrastructure?
Well, that bridge is almost 100 years old, and it had been slated for replacement anyway. But, it says we need to keep ahead of that, of our maintenance and on our bridges and roads. In places, we're sorely lacking that right now.
And as you mentioned, the closure comes as the Iowa Transportation Department is planning to build a replacement bridge by 2027. So do you think this bridge closure now is a preview of what's to come in terms of traffic rerouting?
It probably will be to a certain extent, but it affects people more that live on either side of the river in that area, getting to work or school. It's a big problem for them. That's a heck of a long ways to detour around, almost an hour by the time you figure either coming back to Prairie and then back up the river, or the other way to La Crosse and back down. That's a good hour detour.
Wow. Well, let's talk about water. Prairie du Chien's common council members approved a clean water fund pilot project. Can you explain what this project is?
Sure. What it is DNR has their new regulations and their data on what phosphorus amounts can be released into the river from our wastewater treatment plant. And they have the level so low at this point that we're working on an upgrade for our plant now. We're just starting that. But in the meantime, we're working on this pilot program where if we can do rehab on streams or creeks that empty into the Mississippi, that gets us points that we can put towards toward our plant in the short term to keep us within the DNR regulations.
How much funding do you have to rehab streams and creeks to reduce the flow of these nutrients?
We have, right now, we have just over $1 million.
Is that enough for you in order to be able to carry, you know, to get within the requirements, the DNR requirements?
At this point, it should be.
Mm-hmm.
We had done a similar project a couple years ago. We had rehabbed a stream just north of the city limits here on another street project we did, and we received credits off of that. So this is going to be pretty similar to what we did before. I know people listening in from around the city, they think, well, why the heck are we sticking our money in something like that? But it's all part of the DNR regulations, and it buys us some time to get our plant upgraded and to where we need it to be.
You know, pilot projects from the DNR are sometimes classified as non-traditional water projects. Is this, would you put this into the non-traditional category, or is this something that other communities are doing as well?
Other communities are also doing this, but it's something new. Like, so we did one already a couple years ago, but it is something newer for us.
And did you get the results that you anticipated a couple years ago?
Pretty much. Yeah, it worked out pretty well. That's why we went ahead with this next one.
What does rehabbing mean with these waterways? What is involved?
It's basically just doing the banks of the stream or the creek and cleaning them out, and that pretty much takes care of it.
We're talking with the mayor of Prairie du Chien. Dave Hemmer is with us as we discuss priorities and different new developments in southwestern Wisconsin. You can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So the DNR identifies numerous counties with PFAS contamination, forever chemicals, including Crawford County, where you are. Are PFAS in Prairie du Chien's drinking water?
No.
Are you able
Not
to do...
time, yeah. And we want to keep it that way.
Yeah. Are you able to do enough testing so that you can be continually, you know, monitor this issue?
Yes, we're doing that.
And, you know, the state legislature recently passed a bill that would unlock $125 million for addressing PFAS, but Governor Evers has signaled he will veto the bill over how it would limit the DNR in its regulations. How do you feel about the response by state lawmakers in addressing PFAS at the state level?
Well... I think they could do more. I mean, they pass it on down to the local municipalities, but they need to give us the funding to be able to do it.
Do you worry about PFAS in your community and your wells?
Of course we do. We have 5 wells right now, and we're constantly monitoring them, and checking them. But yes, that is a big issue.
Have you learned from other communities around La Crosse as they grapple with PFAS? I'm thinking about the town of Campbell, for instance, which is about, 60-some miles from you.
That's exactly what we've been thinking because, Campbell's not that far from us, and they haven't been able to drink their water for going on 3 or 4 years, I believe.
So, the city's website says the water department has the wellhead protection plan to safeguard public water from contamination. Would the Clean Water Fund pilot project influence protections that are already in place?
Yes, they would.
In what way?
Well, the way we have it now, it prevents contamination right now, and... that's what we want to keep doing, obviously.
When you look at the resource of water for Prairie du Chien. I mean, you are right there on the Mississippi River. And you also have competing priorities. You have Main Street. You have your different economies and employers. How do you prioritize what comes first in order to spend, you know, scarce and very valuable the dollars you have?
We just try to do the best we can. Obviously, water is a big, it's life-giving, actually. So we want to protect our water source at all costs.
Dave,
I would say that's number one.
That is number one. Dave Hemmer is with us, mayor of Prairie du Chien, the city just above the confluence of the Mississippi River and Wisconsin Rivers. You can join the conversation. Call in with the question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As we check in with mayors from time to time across Wisconsin and explore priorities, we have Prairie du Chien's Dave Hemmer in Crawford County. Hemmer was first elected in 2010. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mayor Hemmer, can you give us a bit of a tour? What would you like people to know about Prairie du Chien?
Well, we're the state's second oldest city, of course, and we're, like we've talked about, we're on the Mississippi River. We have lots of events going on throughout the summer every year, and the more people that join us, the better we like it.
What is your favorite event?
We have probably the Prairie Villa Rendezvous over on St. Farrell Island every summer. Last year, we had their 350th anniversary of the Marquette and Joliet.
How close?
Their 150th celebration last summer also. So it was a pretty big weekend.
How it sounds like also a bit of a collaboration with communities around you. How close are you with your communities, you know, in Wisconsin, but also on the Iowa side?
We work pretty well with right across the river there with the city of Marquette and McGregor.
Mm-hmm.
The bridge goes right from Prairie over to Marquette, and we have a lot of people going both ways. There's a lot of people from Iowa that work in the city of Prairie du Chien every day, so we get along very well with them, and our surrounding townships, we get along fairly well, too. We try to work together as much as possible on things because it all benefits. If it benefits, let's say, Bridgeport Township, Prairie du Chien gets a benefit out of it also.
Let's talk about the public safety building in the works. Last fall, the Prairie du Chien Common Council approved nearly $7 million in local funds to build this new public safety center. The funding is in addition to the nearly $5 million in federal funds approved last year. Why does Prairie du Chien need a public safety center? Can you describe it?
Sure. Our reason we need it is our fire station we have now is 50 years old. And they have outgrown the facility. The trucks are larger nowadays, and we don't have enough room to fit all of our equipment in the space that we have. And also, our police department had been housed for the last, probably 40 or 50 years. We'd in with the county at the county facility. Well, the county facility, they are going to expand and build a bigger facility on site there, and it was just time for us to go our separate ways and and each have our own facilities. So that's what we're doing.
What is the timeline for construction of it?
I think we're hoping to be in within 2 years, breaking ground. We're working on the site now that we have is the old Memorial Hospital site on the south end of Prairie, kind of in the center of town. They have agreed to donate the site to the city, so we've already started our phase one environmental studies on it, and hopefully, if everything goes well, we can get it break ground there within, I'd say, with less than 2 years, hopefully.
Do you think a center like this could improve emergency response times?
Yes, I think it could. It's more of a central location than where our fire department is now. The only drawback is where our fire department is now is right on a highway coming into the east side of Prairie du Chien, where this new center will be a block off one of the main thoroughfares. But of all the sites, we looked all over the city, and this was the best one we could come up with. It would fit our needs. And like I said, the hospital had agreed to donate the site to us, so that's where we're going to move forward.
I would imagine, too, it would improve coordination between emergency, like police and fire and local EMS all being together.
That's what we're hoping for. That is what we're hoping for.
Let's turn to flooding. Prairie du Chien was hit by a major river flooding last spring. Are there better protections now? And is the recovery complete?
I would say the recovery is complete. As far as protections, we do as much as we possibly can. It's the river. You're not going to stop it. And the curious thing about it was last year was, I think it was the third highest flood on record. Mm. And by the end of the summer, the Mississippi River was at record lows. So you never know with the river.
Yeah, it's been such a warm winter here. We've got drought conditions around the state. I wonder what might the Mississippi's crest be like this spring?
Well, so far, unless we get a bunch of rain up north, I would say there will be little to no flooding, at least here in Prairie. I would guess up and down the river because it's not very high right now. And this is due to the time of year that it starts to come up a little bit.
Well, I mean, you've been mayor since 2010. You've seen higher years. You've seen lower years. I wonder, what is your approach to working with residents and the federal government, the state, you know, during and after floods? What is your approach to, you know, flood relief?
Well, we keep track of everything. We've worked with FEMA in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Wisconsin Emergency Management also, we work with them. So we just try and keep track of everything, every last dollar that's spent. And hopefully in the past, we've gotten reimbursement from both agencies if we meet the level that there's a certain level that you have to meet dollar wise to get reimbursement.
Has that happened in an efficient way? Do you hear from residents that are able to rebuild efficiently?
Thankfully, anybody who was affected by the flood hasn't had that much damage where it would say ruin, you know, destroy their house or anything like that, because back in the 70s, the federal government made everybody move off St. Farrell Island, because before that, back in from forever till the 60s, there would be flooding over there every year, and the people would just do their best to clean up everything and move on with their lives. And that was a big controversy back in the 70s, making everybody move off that island.
With climate change,
but that took care of a lot of
the
flooding issues for most of the residents in Prairie. Not all, but most.
We're in conversation with Dave Hemmer, Prairie du Chien's mayor, as we talk about developments and a look forward. You can join in with questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. So looking to ports, Wisconsin has 15 ports across the state, including in Prairie du Chien. How does the port support the local economy?
We have our port right now is run by a company called Gavilon, and we receive tariffs from every ton of grain that comes into the port and gets shipped out. And so right now, we're always looking to expand that, but right now that's basically what we have. I'd also, if you don't mind, I'd like to go back for one second when we're talking about the Public Safety Center and that $6.9 or $7 million figure you were talking about. That also includes our borrowing for a new fire truck that we currently are getting built, and also a new dump truck for the street department. So it's not all just for the Public Safety Center approved the borrowing for.
With just out of curiosity, is that an electric fire truck?
No.
Okay.
It's $1 million as it is. I would shudder to think what an electric fire truck would cost.
Had to ask, Mayor Hemmer.
I know.
Well, so, you know, back to the port for one more moment here.
Sure.
I understand it can dock paddle wheel cruise boats. Do these cruise boats contribute to local tourism, or what's happening there?
The last I saw is the cruise boats that the American Queen has ceased operations.
Oh.
I saw that in a press release here last week, I believe it was. I don't remember exactly why they're no longer coming up and down the river. I think money-wise is a big thing. They weren't making enough money, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't had any stop here in the last 2 years, but before that, yeah, we'd have one stop at least once or twice a summer.
In our last moments together, how's Main Street doing? What does it look like to you? Is it healthy?
It could always be better, but I don't think it's in bad shape. But we're always looking to expand, bring more business to town.
What is the obstacle to get those businesses into town?
Well, I have a place to put them, number one.
Mm.
And number two, competing with other villages, towns, cities in the general area. It's all a competition to bring a business to your town. Any bigger business, smaller businesses, we've had good luck with that. They get these local entrepreneurs that want to start a business up.
Yeah.
We're working with the Main Street Program and our Driftless Development County Economic Development Corporation we've had a couple of pop-up shops.
Well, Mayor Hemmer, thank you for joining us. Dave Hemmer is mayor of Prairie du Chien in Crawford County. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Teamsters report their membership at 1.3 million employed in a variety of public and private industries with hundreds of locals nationwide. As Teamsters Local 200 votes for decertification, we learn about why employees from Keurig Dr. Pepper facilities in Eau Claire, Oshkosh, and Tomah are cutting ties with the union. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mark Mix is president of the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Kate, it's good to be on with you. Thanks for the opportunity. And it sounds like it's going to be a great weekend in Wisconsin.
Yes, it is. Thanks for being
Weather-wise.
Here. Yes.
Yeah.
We also have Ray Kotz with us, an employee at Keurig Dr. Pepper in Oshkosh. Ray, welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Ray, let's start with you. You have 20 years with Keurig Dr. Pepper, and Teamsters Local 200 has been there for your tenure. What marked the tipping point for you wanting to remove the union?
Recently, I went back to a union position. I actually spent some time in some non-union position, so I got to see the full benefits the company was offering. And then I ended up I went back to a union position due to the money they were throwing at CDL, Class A CDL drivers. And I ended up like losing vacation and losing benefits moving back over to the union position.
What did you find as the biggest differences between, as you say, working in a union position versus a non-union position with the company?
The biggest thing was just that the benefits were worse. You know, my vacation under the union capped out at 4 weeks. Under the company, I've got almost 7 weeks of paid vacation after 20 years. Under the union, it was four. That's a huge difference on a yearly, you know, calendar.
So it was the time off. Were there other types of benefits that the union position couldn't provide you as a driver?
We just did special enrollment with the company plan, and I actually got additional benefits at pretty much the same cost. My cost went down $2 a week on my benefits, and I was able to add legal insurance. I doubled my dental coverage. You can double your vision coverage. The union, under the union plan, I was paying. It wasn't a lot, but I had to pay for a short-term disability and long-term disability. That's all included for free under the company plan. So just my medical, dental, health benefits increased.
Okay, so you had better health care coverage at a lower cost point, better time off. I want to turn to you, Mark, because looking at these statistics here, the Economic Policy Institute says 191,000 people joined a union last year, but overall, the percentage of workers represented by unions is down from past years. What do you make of this shift in unionization?
Yeah, well, first of all, Kate, thanks for the opportunity to talk. And Ray, it's good to hear you. I have never met Ray, although one of our attorneys helped Ray navigate the labyrinthine-like process of decertification of a union, which is very difficult. But back to the statistics and what's happening, you know, there are more jobs being created. And if we look at it from a right-to-work state versus non-right-to-work state, you know, the jobs are heading there. And in 19 of the 27 states in 2023, the union density increased. So in 70% of the right-to-work states, the union density actually increased. But in 13 of the 23 non-right-to-work states, the four union states, that was a reduction in 13, almost 57% of the states that are non-right-to-work had a reduction in union density. So, you know, one of the things that Ray talked about I think is important is that, look, the union can provide certain things. They can provide benefits and vacation. But when employees look at it, you know, they find that sometimes the benefits are not what they're cracked up to be. And the fact that the union contract locks you in for 3, 4, or 5 years – when environments can change, cost of living can change, conditions can change. We saw it from 2020 to 2020 on an annual basis. It makes sense to basically have a little bit of leverage and a little bit of flexibility. And unfortunately, with union contracts, that really exists. And so for Ray and his team out there, for I think what almost 60% of I think 60% of the workers that had to vote about this Teamster representation, they said no and looked for a better package that came from the employer.
Ray, can you talk us through the vote and how it went down?
We spent a merchandiser over in Toma wanted to kick this off because we had the three branches, Eau Claire, Toma, and Oshkosh, and there wasn't really any communication between the like employees of the branches because they're so far apart across the state. I mean, they're almost 3 hours away from Oshkosh each. So a merchandiser in Toma actually got a hold of me, and then I found out Toma was interested. So I ended up filing the petition with the help of the National Right to Work Organization. And we had to get, I think, 30% signatures to kick that off, which we did. There was enough interest to do it. And then, I don't know, there was a year. It took us a year of just sort of campaigning within the company because there were some people who were fighting it. Some very pro-union members. And then we eventually came down to a vote. We did a mail-in vote because of the three branches at different locations. So everybody sent in a secret ballot via mail, and then the votes were counted up.
Ray Kotz is with us, a Keurig Dr. Pepper employee in Oshkosh. Mark Mix, president of the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. As we talk about organized labor, you can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I wonder, Ray, you know, in 2022, there was a Teamsters chapter in Illinois that reported issues working with Keurig Dr. Pepper. The chapter leader described a broken relationship with the company and difficulty in talking about, like, overtime and holiday schedules and safety. Do these issues sound familiar at all to concerns with Local 200 in Wisconsin?
No, as far as I'm understanding with the company, it wasn't, we didn't really have any ill relations with the company. One of the biggest problems was we kept getting 5-year contracts, which in my view only support the company. You can't, when the COVID thing hit and then all the inflation after that, all the cost of living went up, and we were locked into a 5-year contract under the old wages. These constantly just got 5-year contracts. And that was one of the biggest problems, is you can't. So in my 20 years, this was like my fourth contract. Fourth time the union did anything for us, like negotiation wise.
Mark, I want you to jump in here. In terms of 5-year contracts, is this something that is typical you see in locals around the country?
Yeah, it is. Union officials try to get the longest possible contract they can. And as Ray mentioned, the employer is interested in that too, because that relationship, that monopoly bargaining agreement between the employer and the union that covers all the employees is basically locked in for that 5 years. That's what I mentioned, kind of the flexibility that comes with the ability to talk to your employer about benefits and cost of living and other issues that pop up, whether it be a 3-year contract, which is kind of the minimum that will be negotiated. But union officials would love to have 5-year contracts, and in many cases, employers would as well. And that's where the employee rights gets violated. That's exactly what Ray's talking about here, is that, you know, you had, 8-9% inflation, and all of a sudden this contract that you're under for the next 3 or 4 or 5 years says there are no escalators, there's no chance to reopen. I mean, some contracts may have those provisions, but oftentimes they don't. And so, you know, you have the business on one side, the union on the other, and you have the employee that's left out of the equation that's saying, hey, all my buddies over here at Company B are getting, you know, they're talking to their employer about wage increases and benefit increases in a time of high inflation. And unfortunately, you're locked into that contract for 5 years. And so 5 years, I think, is the extent. That's the longest you can have under the National Labor Relations Act. But that's primarily where employer and a union wants to go, not necessarily where the employees want to go.
Mark Mix is president of the Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. Ray Kotz is with us, an Oshkosh-based Keurig Dr. Pepper driver, led a successful effort to remove the Teamsters union by submitting a decertification petition last year. Call in with a question, share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A unit of beverage drivers and warehouse workers from Keurig Dr. Pepper facilities in Eau Claire, Oshkosh, and Tomah, they submit a union decertification from a Teamsters local ending collective bargaining. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ray Kotz is here, driver at Keurig Dr. Pepper in Oshkosh. Mark Mix is president of the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. Let's bring in Karen in Green Bay. Karen, what are your thoughts?
Well, our family was on my husband's private insurance for most years, and then I obtained a union job, so I started... So then we switched everything to my policy because the benefits were so much better. And right now, I know that the right to work thing, and this all sounds great, and they're all singing their song, the private industries, because they can't get workers. So they're going to inflate their benefits and all of those things. But what's going to happen if it turns around? I have nothing bad to say about unions, but in private industry, just seeing what we went through in my husband's policy when they had tons of workers, things changed. So, you know, it was like up and down and up and down. Anyway,
Karen, thank you for that personal insight. You know, Ray, what happens when the economy sours? Do you feel like you have any leverage over wages and benefits or working conditions now?
Well, in a lot of our cases, we have Class A CDLs, so there's an open market out there. I mean, I can go anywhere and work. I know that doesn't apply to everybody, and you know, but us drivers, we're a skilled position. It's a Class A CDL position. So if the company were to turn sour on us, I got a Class A CDL, so it's not like I'm restricted to this particular role or I'm going to be poor out of a job.
Jacob in Madison is called in to ask, is curious, why did the people who supported the union, did they support it for political reasons? Did they support it for personal reasons? Ray, did you find out?
A couple of our guys were just ideologically driven. They were just pro-union just because, like, and I don't have anything against unions as a whole, or, I'm sure there's some good unions out there. I've heard stories of, like the United Auto Workers, they got an amazing package and raise this, last time. But our union was just, like I said, 5-year contracts, sort of ineffective. But some of the people were just, they were just pro-union because, you need a union, you need a union. We had a very minimal pension under the union, and now Keurig's given us a 7% match on retirement funds that we don't, to our 401ks. So we got better retirement out of it too. And some of the younger guys, some of the newer guys, they sort of got fear-mongered by the union. They were worried about if we get rid of the union, you could just lose your job. The company could just fire you and there's no protection. But I kept trying to explain to these. I'm like, you got a Class A CDL. They're not going to fire Class A CDL drivers.
Well, let's take another call. Marty in Elkhorn is here. Marty, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Good morning. Many, many moons ago, I was in a union. Our contract came up. We voted, I believe by ballots, that we wanted to go on strike, and we did. A couple weeks later, we got called back into yay or nay, the new contract. This time, it was a show of hands, and boom, the mallet comes down, it's passed. And from that point on, I couldn't help but think that the contractors owned the union. Any sustenance to that? Am I just, crazy?
Marty, thank you for that story. Mark Mix, can you weigh in there on the voting itself in unions, whether by ballot or by raising a hand?
Yeah, Kate, that's up to the union and how they decide to do it. But the idea of going on strike, that's an internal union vote. And then approving a contract that's negotiated between union officials and the employer is, again, another union orchestrator or administrator vote. So how they do it, I think there may not be any official rules or regulations. Some unions may have constitutions saying, hey, a vote for a contract needs to be a secret ballot vote. And, to Ray's point, that's one of the most important parts of all this is the ability for individuals to have their views protected from others because the situation does get very difficult. But most of the time, as Marty mentioned, the vote is a union-decided process of how they vote, whether to go on strike and whether to accept the contract. And under the UAW contract, if you remember after the strike with UAW, there were several large local units that voted against the contract. Mm-hmm. I think three of the largest GM units voted against the contract that was being offered, but obviously the majority of people voted for the contract, so it was applied across the entire UAW system for GM employees and Ford employees and Stellantis employees. But there was quite a bit of opposition to the contract in some very large units among the UAW.
Mark Mix there, president of the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. Ray Kotz is with us, Keurig Dr. Pepper employee based in Oshkosh. 20 years with the company as we talk about organized labor and decertification. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. You know, yesterday on our program, we heard from senior economist Kristen Brody at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. And Mark, Kristen said wages under unions tend to be higher.
When you have labor unions, people are likely to earn higher wages. Research has shown that for many years. And we know that African Americans have the highest union membership rate.
Mark, what do you make of those comments that belonging to a union equates? Go ahead.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research on that. The Economic Policy Institute, who you cited at the beginning, does that. They're funded by the AFL-CIO and lots of unions. But here's what happened. Let's look at the UAW contract that Ray mentioned just briefly and I talked a little bit about. I mean, you look, the highest wage that comes out of that UAW contract for manufacturing, for automotive manufacturing, will be $32.32. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the government entity that keeps track of this, non-union wages for manufacturing employees is $35.32. So about 17% higher when you factor in union dues. And so when someone from the Federal Reserve talks about wages in a gross sense, they're very rarely and very often do they not adjust for cost of living. I mean, obviously it costs more to live in New York City than it does in Provo, Utah. And if you don't adjust for the cost of living, yes, a union plumber in New York makes more money per hour than a non-union plumber out in Provo, Utah. But it's very likely that when you adjust for cost of living, you see that the non-union plumber in Provo, Utah is better off than the union plumber in New York. So those are numbers. You know, we all have numbers. I have numbers. I can cite numbers as well. But when you adjust for cost of living, what we do find is that workers in right-to-work states, whether they be union or non-union, have roughly about $3,500 more to spend in disposable income than folks in non-right-to-work states.
Let's go to Nate in Milwaukee now. Nate, what would you like to bring up?
Hi, thank you for calling me. And I looked at the vote totals for this, and I would like to point out that I think this is how a decertification election ought to be done, where the majority of votes went a certain way and that way was followed. And in contrast, you have the majority of the decertification elections under Act 10, where most of the workers vote to keep their union and it gets decertified and basically denies the freedom of those workers because of that, in addition to denying those workers from being able to use their union to ask for better benefits, as one of your guests has pointed out, is something that a lot of workers would like. As a side note, since we were comparing states, I think that a lot of right-to-work states are also further down south, and comparatively, they have a whole range of other social issues like worse murder rates and stuff like that. So there might be a different reason for lower costs of living in addition to that.
Nate, thank you for bringing those insights. And Ray, I want to land with you here. You know, you've got 20 years with the company. Do you see many more? How do you feel about your employment going forward?
Like I said, I'm a transport driver. I drive down to Chicago every day for my job. I can retire out at this job, and as long as it doesn't ever get canceled or anything, I don't foresee me going anywhere else. I've looked. Keurig Dr. Pepper is very competitive on their pay. It's not like other places are throwing more money at us than Keurig Dr. Pepper is, on as far as that goes, and the benefits are pretty good.
Well, Ray and Mark, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Ray Kotz, driver at the Keurig Dr. Pepper facility in Oshkosh. Mark Mix is president of the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Getting older isn't cheap. One national group estimates the average annual cost for assisted living care would be more $60,000 in Wisconsin this year. And seniors and disabled adults who run out of savings can get help to cover those costs through the state's Medicaid program. But that transition from paying out of pocket for using Medicaid has led to some residents being ousted. Wisconsin saw a series of Medicaid recipients forced to relocate in 2022 and 2023, and experts say more funding and regulation are needed. But Addie Costello reports that since those incidents, not much has changed.
Sitting at his kitchen table, Dale Hunke flips through pages of documents from his parents' assisted living facilities. He pulls the files from a stretched-out accordion folder where he organizes records from years of helping his parents find long-term care.
I never thought about this day coming, but it comes, and you get through it.
In 2021, Hunke helped his parents move to what is now a Cedarhurst assisted living facility in Verona.
It was a perfect spot for them.
Part of what made it perfect was that they accepted Medicaid. Hunke estimated his parents could afford roughly 2 years of care. After that, they would need Medicaid. Hunky's dad successfully made the transition before he passed away in 2022. But months later, when Hunky's mom was nearing her transition, he found out Cedarhurst in Verona ended its Medicaid contract.
I've done the best I could with shielding mom from the worst of it.
But none of his carefully kept records could prevent the 88-year-old woman from having to move. Federal law bans nursing homes from rejecting residents because of a transition to Medicaid, if the facility accepted Medicaid when the resident moved in. But no state or federal policies protect assisted living residents in the same situation, leaving families like Hunky's to scramble to find new care.
I was just consumed with it. I did nothing else for 3 days, I think. Because at that point, I was like, I've got to get her out of there.
Facilities don't want to force seniors out of their home, says Mike Bahowski. He's the president and CEO of the Wisconsin Assisted Living Association. But, he says, Wisconsin's Medicaid program doesn't pay enough to cover the cost of most recipients' care.
We've had a number of facilities have to close in 2022 because they cannot make financial ends meet because the reimbursement rate is so low.
Wisconsin's Department of Health Services is hoping to get a small increase to reimbursement rates approved later this year using temporary pandemic relief funds. But current reimbursements have led some facilities to end their Medicaid contracts entirely. More commonly, facilities set stricter financial requirements for residents. Many require prospective residents to show that they can pay for 1, 2, or even 3 years of care out of pocket in order to stay at the facility once they transition to Medicaid.
Sometimes even that written agreement might not hold up.
That's Kim Marhaney, Wisconsin State Long-Term Care Ombudsman. She says if an assisted living facility is sold or ends its Medicaid contract, they can get out of the agreement.
We see residents who have spent 2 to 3 years and more of their own personal dollars that are being asked to move someplace else.
Out-of-pocket pay requirements also limit care for seniors already on Medicaid.
We are starting to see those gaps where there just isn't the diversity of options available to consumers that there used to be.
And Eric Carlson believes accepting Medicaid only after out-of-pocket pay violates federal law. He's an attorney and advocacy director with the legal nonprofit Justice and Aging.
You can't put the screws to people who are eligible for Medicaid because your promise to the state Medicaid program is that you will accept Medicaid, and that's not conditional.
Legal or not, Dale Hunke says by the time they found out she needed to move, his mother was just months away from needing Medicaid, leaving Hunke with just 3 options to tour. The first two were immediate no's, but the last facility?
It was like an answer to our prayers.
Despite her limited savings, the facility accepted his mom. She moved there in June, and this month, she successfully transitioned to Medicaid. Addie Costello, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this piece was produced in partnership with the nonprofit Wisconsin Watch. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about a quirky Wisconsin law.
For years, yellow margarine was illegal in Wisconsin. Why? Well, the history is a little complicated and a little bit strange, but its roots lie in Wisconsin's proud heritage as the dairy state. WPR's Jenny Peek brings us the story.
Wisconsin is America's dairyland. It's a title we take seriously. The state is home to over 1 million cows that produce almost 2.5 billion pounds of milk each month. We even host the World Dairy Expo. For Wisconsin lawmakers, it's an industry worth protecting, and its importance can be traced through a history of sometimes oddball laws. Ed Peel of Columbus, Ohio, reached out to WPR's Wisconsin about one such law. He visited his grandparents in Kenosha as a child and remembers the margarine being white instead of yellow. His grandfather had told him, "It's a Wisconsin law." So Peel asked Wisconsin, "Is that true?" It reminded me of a story I'd heard from my father-in-law, Rob Howell, who grew up in Kenosha. One of his chores as a boy was to mix the yellow dye into the margarine.
Of course, it came in these rectangular 1-pound packages with a little bead of yellow dye. And you had to break that bead and then spread it through the pound of oleo, which is very time consuming. But it was a god-awful mess, you know, because by the time you'd squeezed this oleo for 10 minutes, it had softened way up. Then you had to squirt it out into some sort of container. So it was always pretty unappetizing, but it was super unappetizing when it was white.
Not being able to buy yellow margarine in Wisconsin drove many residents, like the Howells, across state lines to buy the cheaper pre-mixed goods. Border towns like Waukegan, Illinois, boasted pop-up oleo stands advertising their product to traveling Wisconsinites.
Sometimes if we knew ahead of time that we were going to do that, we'd ask our neighbors if they wanted us to pick up a few pounds of colored oleo for them, and we often did, and so often came back with quite a haul of this illegal margarine.
Wisconsin started regulating margarine in 1881. Dave Driscoll, a curator at the Wisconsin Historical Society, says that while the laws have varied, the intent was simple: ensure fair prices for dairy products and prevent fraud.
The most durable objection to margarine was that it's fraudulent in that it's misrepresenting itself as butter. And, you know, it's kind of a pasty white by itself, which in the literature is referred to things like, you know, a corpse-like white, you know. So I think they felt that as long as it didn't look appealing, it didn't look like something delicious for your toast, that, you know, that was good enough.
But people got tired of the regulations and began pushing lawmakers to repeal them.
Throughout the Great Depression and then World War II rationing, more and more people actually had experience of consuming margarine. It was like, well, I've been eating this for years now. You know, it wasn't all that bad and it's significantly cheaper, so I should be able to buy this.
By 1953, only Minnesota and Wisconsin had laws banning yellow margarine. In 1963, Minnesota repealed its ban, leaving Wisconsin as the lone holdout. 4 years later, in 1967, Wisconsin joined the rest of the nation in legalizing yellow margarine. I asked Driscoll why it took so long.
I think in general, it's safe to say that the dairy interests in the state were as strong or stronger here than in most other states.
Even with yellow margarine legal, butter is the go-to spreadable fat in Wisconsin. It's a welcome change for Howell, who still remembers trying butter for the first time when he was 7.
I got one day at Forest Park Elementary School a hot lunch, and I tasted that and was immediately impressed at how much better it was than margarine, which is terrible. And went home with that and was told by my mom that it was butter was too expensive and unhealthy.
But once it was up to him, he steered clear of oleo.
I haven't eaten margarine, at least knowingly, for probably 50 years.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Well, I get them in the stalls, fed and hobbled good. They seem so nice and quiet, standing chewing their cud. But when you get down beside them, put the milkers in place, that tail...
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Department of Natural Resources says Wisconsin is home to over 25,000 miles of groomed trails for snowmobiling. But Wisconsin's historically warm winter is proving to be a disappointing season for owners of the more than 200,000 registered snowmobiles in our state. So with record temperatures this week exceeding 60 degrees, the state's snow report says no trails are open. For a closer look at how the season is affecting snowmobilers, we talked with Brianna Crotto, who is serving as this year's Miss Snowflake for the Association of Wisconsin Snowmobile Clubs. WPR producer Courtney Everett spoke with Crotto and first asked how Crotto came into this role.
I was about 3 years old. I've been riding in front of my parents for as long as I can remember. And then once I got my snowmobile safety when I was about 12 years old, I was able to go out on my own and just kind of rode around on my parents' sleds, drove around with them a little bit. And then when I turned, I believe it was 15 or 16, I actually was gifted with my first sled from my parents. So I was able to go out on my own and ride with my family and stuff. And ever since probably that time I got the sled, that was kind of when I started to get more involved with my club. I was old enough to kind of go out and do more of the work. I always rode around with my dad, like just doing trail work and stuff. But then once I hit that 16 to 17 year old age gap there, I was able to go out and kind of get used to the groomers and stuff and totally got more involved at that age. So it's been a long story. It's always been in my family since like the 1960s. So it goes a long ways back. It's pretty cool.
You mentioned your club. I'm assuming you're talking about the Chautauqua Snowflyer Snowmobile Club, right?
Yes. Yep. Up in Chautauqua, Wisconsin. That is correct.
And tell me a little bit more about the club and your involvement.
Yeah. So our club started in the 1960s. My great grandpa actually was the first president. So my family's been involved with that club for as long as I can remember. Located in Chautauqua, Wisconsin, we've got roughly 110 members. We cover about 80 miles of trail. And my involvement with the club has been mostly trail work with my dad. We kind of have our own trail that we take care of for just signage and stuff. And then I also have been learning how to groom and roll trails, which has been really fun. I like working with landowners. I have an agriculture background, so it's been a lot of working with farmers and stuff, which I really enjoy because we have a lot of farm fields that we cross with our snowmobile trail. Just things with membership, trying to recruit younger members. We're trying to get a chaos group started up there. It hasn't happened yet, but we're working on it. So there's been a lot of different things going on throughout the years for me.
What's chaos?
Chaos is the AWSC Kids and Adults on Sleds program. So that is for the youth in the AWSC coming up. So it's kind of getting them used to the ropes of what AWSC does and getting them more involved with their clubs in a general term. There's much more to it, but in a general term, that's where that.
Yeah, that sounds so neat. Now, earlier you mentioned the trail maintenance. What does that really entail?
So a lot of it is going to be your signage, you know, making sure that everybody's safe out there on the trails, knowing what's coming up, your costume signs, your trailblazers, your stop signs, all of that stuff. You're going to have a step where you're brushing trails and you're mowing trails. So brushing would just mean, you know, making sure it's clear enough for the groomers to go through. You're mowing, just keeping things down so that way when the snow does fall, you can keep it as smooth as possible for the groomers. And you're not hitting branches and stuff too along the way, which you obviously want to protect your equipment as long as you can. And then after that, once the snow falls, we go out and we roll the trails. So what that is we actually have an old plastic culvert that we put on the back of the groomer. And that creates more of, like, you can imagine what a culvert pattern looks like. And sure. What that does is, see, it's on an open field, and that actually brings in the snow as like a snowdrift. And so then it pulls in more snow as the wind goes across it to kind of build up that trail. And then once we get more snow, then we can go across it with the heavier groomer and hopefully have the smoothest trail we can make with what we have. So that's kind of the generic steps of grooming and the trail work.
We're talking about snowmobiling with Wisconsin's Miss Snowflake, Brianna Crotto. The Rice Lake native represents the Association of Wisconsin Snowmobile Clubs. Brianna, more than 600 snowmobile clubs participate in the Association of Wisconsin Snowmobile Clubs. How does your role of Miss Snowflake support snowmobilers?
Yeah, so my role is basically I travel the whole state for a full year. And what I do is I get invited to different, I get safety classes, I go to club events, fundraisers, different, I mean, if we have snow, I'll go to like different club rides and 50th. I was at a 50th anniversary earlier this year. Anything involving clubs and any event that they're having, I can go to. And most of the time a club will invite me to come. And what I do is I just go there. I see what the clubs are doing. I see what I can do from the AWSC level to help them out to improve their club. Maybe take some ideas from other clubs and tell them what other clubs are doing across the state to help them improve in any way that they are looking to improve. There's a lot to it. It's a pretty big job. It's a lot of miles. I wish there was more miles on the trail this year, but it's not happening so far with the winter, but it's all good. At least I can still go out and meet the people, which is my main goal of the year, because the AWSC family and the club members and the overall snowmobile industry has such a cool culture. And it's just fun to go out and see these people and what they're doing on a day-to-day basis all year round.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the snow lately. It really has been kind of sparse. So are you finding yourself, having more time than, to meet with people? How are you filling that gap?
Yeah. So I expected, there was a lot of people that reached out right when I began my reign in October, shortly after the AWSC fall workshop. I had a lot of clubs reaching out, let's go for a ride here, let's go for a ride there. Well, now they're, instead of having their ride, they're still figuring out alternative ways to have a fundraiser or a big raffle or something. That way they can still get people to come in, because ultimately they still need those fundraising dollars to make it throughout the rest of the year. And so I really give big kudos to a lot of the clubs across the state for trying to come up with alternative ways to have events, even though we don't have snow. So they're rocking it out right now. I've seen a lot of events that have had a really good turnout, and it's pretty cool to see. So
that's great. SnowmobileTrader.com is a national online marketplace to buy and sell snowmobiles. Snowmobiles can cost more than $10,000. How can people enter this sport considering that expense?
Oof. Yeah, that is tough. What I like to do is, I've been trying, actually a new idea I've had is to work with my local dealerships in Barron County. And it hasn't happened yet, but it's in the works right now. We're just trying to come up with a way for people to go out and just jump on a sled to try it instead of having to go and buy one, because it's very expensive. It's hard for families. If all four, like say there's four people in a family, and I mean, that's $40,000 at minimum. So you're looking at different costs and stuff like that. And it's like, we need to figure out a way to get people on a sled and try it without them having to go and pay for a sled because it's so expensive. So there's a lot of different people I've talked to that are trying to figure out ways to get more people involved. And there's a lot of AWSC members out there that have a lot of sleds at their house.
Mm-hmm. Like, okay.
It's not everybody's that way, but there are people that I've met that have a lot of sleds, and they're like, I actually just keep them around, so that way people that don't have sleds or my friends can come up and just snowmobile with me. So obviously that's not the same situation for everybody, but it's just kind of cool to hear those stories just because they want to get them more involved and let them go try the sport. So, but yeah, that's kind of where that's at. It's tough. I mean, it's expensive and it's a recreational sport. I mean, you look at the UTV, the ATV stuff. I mean, you're looking at $25,000 to $30,000 going out to a single vehicle, and it's pretty crazy, but at least we're just trying to come up with new ways to try and get more people involved. And even if you're not, I should say this too, if you're not able to buy a sled, there's so many ways you can still become involved with your snowmobile club. And so that's where I try to tell a lot of people, like, you don't have to have a sled to be a part of a club. Like, you can still come out, be a part of the big events. You can still come and help with trail work. You can still learn how to groom. I mean, that's something that the club covers for a cost. And I mean, if you want to get out on the trail and just groom, I think that's the most fun, honestly, because you're just kind of going slow down the trail, super scenic, you're out in the big equipment. Like, that's totally something I enjoy to do. So that's what I tell people. If they don't have a sled at home, just try to jump in with your local club and just try it out. And then from there, maybe try somebody else's sled, and then you'll get hooked in from there.
Well, Brianna, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me. This is awesome.
That is WPR producer Courtney Everett speaking with Brianna Crotto, the 2023-2024 Miss Snowflake for the Association of Wisconsin Snowmobile Clubs. And from snowmobiles to speed skates to cars and electric vehicles, if you missed part of today's program, you can visit our program page anytime, and you can find hundreds of morning show programs in our archives. Visit WPR.org/mornings. It's also all free. It's to stream, to download. And thanks in part because of support from generous listeners like you. Again, that program page is WPR.org/mornings. And another quick plug here. We want to hear your ideas for future programs. You can email your show suggestions to ideas@WPR.org or visit our program page to leave suggestions with a really quick web form. That page again is WPR.org/mornings. Thank you so much. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.